a tiny little book from the Bible about a woman and her mother-in-law. Does this little book actually reveal something overlooked by many about the events of Revelation? What occurred in history at approximately 2000 BC that changes everything you thought you knew about the book of Ecclesiastes? Today's panel is here to shatter the paradigm. Welcome, everyone, to Skywatch TV. I'm Joe Artis Horn. We begin our second installation into a multi-week series on the brand new three-book anthology from Defender Publishing by Dr. Thomas R. Horn, Donna Howell, and Allie Anderson on the mystery of Jesus from Genesis to Revelation. And once again, I'm going to try to wield this massive three-book anthology so that you can see it at home, beautifully bound. We talked last week about the research that Donna's done for this series, Tom, where she basically chronologically organizes the mathematical, can I just say, impossibility that Jesus Christ wasn't exactly who he said he was.
Right.
I think she said the word trillions like a trillion times. You have to go back, all of the trillions, you have to go back and take a look at that episode from the archives. But Tom, this three-book series, The Mysteries of Jesus, there's never been anything like it published ever before. You said last week that after 25 years of pastoring, and almost that again in research, that there were things during your guys' research for this three-book anthology that you yourself had never uncovered before. It is that groundbreaking. It is that fascinating. And of course, it would never fit into one volume, which is why it's been compiled into this three-book anthology that's so beautifully bound. Donna, you had talked about this thing that lots of scholars call the first glimmer of the gospel. Mm-hmm. And we were racing through that at the end of week number one. And I want to pick up there before we get back to what I teased at the intro of this program, having to do with Ruth and something very overlooked that may have relevance to the book of Revelation. So let's dive right back into the first glimmer of the gospel.
So last week we talked a little bit about the psychological infancy that was occurring within the minds of the very first two humans who were ever deceived, and what that deception would have actually looked like. Now, here's what I want to point out, because this is, to me, Genesis 3:15 draws right into the Great Commission and what it means for us today. It matters that they were in their psychological infancy. It matters that we've inherited the sin nature alongside them, because it's kind of the running joke. Darn you, Adam and Eve, you brought sin into the world. The Christians, you know, they do a lot of blaming. And even if they're joking, it's the running joke that if it weren't for Adam and Eve, we would have had a different outcome. No, we absolutely would not have. We explained last week what Barnes Notes refers to as the opening mind would have made anybody in that particular occasion make the same mistake. Mm-hmm. So you look at that and you say, we have equally inherited the sin nature from Adam. Right? Earlier in Genesis, at the formation of man and woman, we have equally inherited the imago Dei, the image of God. Mm-hmm. These two realities are in constant tension with one another. Well, on one hand, we are intrinsically, for reasons even we can't explain when we are not a believer, drawn toward what is good, recognizing that murder is bad. How come that's intrinsically instilled within us? It's because even if you're not saved, when you were formed in your mother's womb, you were given the image of God. Mm-hmm. When you were born into the sin nature that was introduced into the human nature by Adam and Eve. These two things are in constant tension. Why does this matter for the Great Commission? When it comes to witnessing the gospel, we now have everything in common with everybody. You can't look into the world and say, that guy's a homosexual, she offends me, he's a polygamist, because you have everything in common with every single human being when witnessing counts, because you have the tension of the sin nature and the tension of the imago Dei, the image of God instilled within every single person. So this is why the Great Commission changes. We start in Genesis. We're still in Genesis when it comes to theologically what our responsibility is as Christians in the kingdom of God.
Have you guys ever heard this material before?
No.
This, for those that don't know, is what I believe as the son of Tom Horn is his absolute magnum opus. And I've heard people around my father describe this anthology as the greatest portion of any life legacy work that he will leave behind. You know, Donna, most Christians don't even completely understand why the tiny little book of Ruth, switching gears now, appears in the Bible at all. You know, it's a cute little book, right? Some think it's because it traces the genealogy of Christ's bloodline, which is true. But your book, this series, actually takes the link to a whole new level, right?
Yes, and actually Ruth plays directly into our future. A lot of people don't see that. Again, the church hears Ruth and they go, oh, I know this one. Jesus appears in Ruth through the genealogy. Because Ruth and Boaz had Obed, which had Jesse, who had the David, who the messianic line. Yes, right. That is true. And that is one of the major ways that Jesus appears in Ruth. However, there is something so much grander than just lineage, and it's overlooked all the time. It actually plays into one of the most important moments in Revelations. But before we go into exactly how that's true, I want to bring the audience into understanding a little bit more about who Ruth was. Okay. Like we say in the book, I want to let Ruth breathe. Nobody ever does. We hear that sermon, and it's a good sermon, that Ruth left everything and left her old past behind and became a new creation. Sure. She was a proselyte.
Right, that's a great message.
But again, scratching the surface, just barely. So, let's go into it just a little bit. First of all, understand that Moab, this is where Ruth was from. She was a Moabite, right? Moab was a blight on the map for Israel. The very beginnings of Moab was built on the incestuous relations between Lot and his daughter. This can be found in the story of Genesis 19, 30 through 38. And so Lot had been passed out drunk. His daughter did some very crazy things. Bottom line, Moab was born from this unholy union, and it sat out like a blight on the map. His very name means from my father. And so Moab was a very wicked city. Now, the resident god of Moab was Chemosh. And we read in 2 Kings 3:27 that Israel approached and they went, oh my goodness, this is so depraved. And they just kind of backed away slowly. And this is the child sacrificing, incestuous religion climate that Ruth grew up in. Mm-hmm. Now, some of you might be wondering, how then was Ruth allowed to marry Boaz? I'm not going to get into that on today's program, but the book definitely does cover why or how they would have been allowed to marry, considering the prohibition. Moving on, I want to talk about Boaz for a second, bring him to life a little bit for you. First of all, he blesses Ruth freely to gather from his harvest, right? He tells her to enjoy the company of other Israelite women who are at the site. He also goes out of his way to inform her that he's already instructed the men to leave her alone so that she will not be hassled in her place. And then he goes on as far as to say, it hath been showed me what you have done unto Naomi, my mother-in-law, right? He goes as far as to call Ruth a virtuous woman, Ruth 3:11. Does this remind you of anyone? Does this remind you of anyone? Okay, so think about this for a minute. We did allow ourselves to use personality when we wrote this book. So I'm going to read a little bit of a funny line that we had in here. Boaz did not say that she could only have food from his land if she was willing to pay interest, earn her keep, work extra hours, pay him any personal favors or any other requirement. He didn't ask her about her former husband, her past in Moab, whether she plans to corrupt his other field maidens with pagan ideas, whether her lifestyle was such that she needed to be under supervision while she drank from the same vessels as the men, what hair-raising temple activities she may have participated in back home, if she believes in tithing, if she attends confession regularly, whether she has memorized her denomination's fundamental statements of faith, whether she had ever smoked a cigarette, if she felt tempted to smoke a cigarette, or whether blonde was her true hair color, nothing, right? He didn't expect anything of her. And yes, I realize that this list is anachronistic, which means out of space and time, but we did it on purpose because can we learn something from this, right? Can we learn something from this?
Yeah.
It's brutally straightforward. She asked him why in the world he would have ever showed her such kindness, acceptance, and grace. And his answer was quite simply because she had shown kindness, acceptance, and grace to Naomi. So if you listen real close at the coattails of the words of Boaz, we hear somebody else's words, don't we? Straight out of the mouth of Christ, truly I say unto you, inasmuch as you have done it, unto one of the least of these, my brothers, you have done it unto me.
Yep.
We will be remembered in the kingdom of God for the things we did and didn't do.
Wow.
That is what Boaz preaches. And believe it or not, I haven't even touched the best part.
Okay.
This is getting to the best part. Goosebumps. Ruth finds out that Boaz is her kinsman redeemer. Now, that is the Hebrew word goel, What does that mean? All right. So the Hebrew word goel, this is somebody who passed property on to the future generations, somebody who had the executive authority to buy back a property that had been lost or put into some kind of compromise. So if somebody, a Jewish man, had owned his property and he mortgaged it or he leveraged it or he fell on hard times, the kinsman redeemer, the Hebrew goel, would have the exclusive authority to come in and rebuy that and restore it so that he could keep that property in his family. Now, here's the interesting thing that a lot of Christians are not immediately aware of. That particular document that outlined the terms of the contract or the terms of the original property or sale also included, I mean, this is embarrassing to admit, it included the women that were owned by that property, the elderly, the children. The terms of sale was not just land. It was all property and all that that entails. So this scroll was written up all of the contractual obligations, everything that was included in its terms on one side of the parchment. And then it was signed at the bottom by all of the witnesses. Now, this is according to Jeremiah 32:11. All of the witnesses would sign on that parchment. Then it was rolled up and signed on the outside with the witnesses and the goel. And then it was sealed shut. This is so that when the goel later on came forward and said, I would like to buy this land back, or I would like to, you know, do whatever he's going to do to keep it in the family, he had the exclusive right to open it. Only the goel could open the scroll. Only the kinsman redeemer could open the scroll, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is what Boaz did for Ruth. Flip to Revelation 5:1-4. And I, John, saw in the right hand of him, God, that sat on the throne, a scroll written within and on the backside, sealed with 7 seals. Sound familiar? Mm-hmm. And I saw a strong angel proclaiming with a loud voice, who is worthy to open the scroll and to loose the 7 seals thereof? And no man in heaven, nor in earth, nor under the earth, was able to open the scroll, neither to even look thereon. They couldn't even look at it. Mm-hmm. And I wept much, John says. I wept much because no man was found worthy to open and read the scroll, neither to look thereon. Now, the terms of that scroll in this particular moment of Revelation, the terms on that scroll is our redemption.
Mm.
It's the repurchase of our property, our inheritance in the kingdom of God, and nobody can open it, right? That's what's happening in this scene. Now, and I'm going to do the excerpt thing again. Prior to Christ, there was no person in history that could ever be worthy to redeem humanity. Nor has any human person ever been kinsman to God. Think about that. In Boaz terms, we were living on a property with no owner, doomed to wander the earth forever, as no man in heaven, nor in earth, nor under the earth would be able to open the scroll where we resided and consider any kind of repurchase, redemption, or resale of our spiritual conditions to another caretaker who would see to our provision. It's heart-wrenching to see John in this passage weeping at what scholars say represented the damnation of a forgotten humankind with no promise and no future. These authors would have wept too, we say in the book.
Oh, sure.
What a sad, tragic end for all of us. But God, right? In the very next verses, Revelation 5:5-10, we are introduced to the utmost kinsman redeemer, Jesus Christ, known as the Lamb in this scene. Listen to this. One of the elders, one of the witnesses present at the time this scroll was sealed, and therefore one of the only ones who would know what was stated inside, saith unto me, weep not. Behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, hath prevailed to open the scroll and to loose the 7 seals thereof. And I beheld in the midst of the elders, again, the witnesses, stood a lamb, Jesus, as it had been slain. And he came and he took the scroll out of the right hand of God, who sat on the throne. And when he had taken the scroll, the elders fell down before the lamb and they sung a new song, saying, thou art worthy to take the scroll and to open the 7 seals thereof. For thou wast slain and hast redeemed us to God by the blood of every kindred and tongue and people and nation, and hast made unto our God kings and priests, and we shall reign on the earth. That's our inheritance. And I'm not even done. What follows is a scene of praise wherein every living creature, both in heaven and on earth, worship the Lamb who is the only kinsman of humankind. Right? He's kinsman to God and kinsman to humankind. He's the literally the only kinsman to both.
Mm-hmm.
Whose spilt blood was the currency for the repurchase of the land and its otherwise lost inhabitants. Jesus, the only entity in the universe who is literally kinsman to humanity and God, was willing to take the burden of our fate into his hands, loose the otherwise unloosable seven seals, and unroll the details of our contract for all to see and for all to inherit freely. Christ was our relative. Mm-hmm. Without his blood-bought purchase, right, our destiny would be no more glorious than to remain spiritually lethargic while we wandered the damned corners of the earth, belonging to no one other than the prince of the power of the air and awaiting death and judgment. So one final comparison between Jesus and Boaz, and then I promise I'll shut up. Boaz's gentle, loving interactions to Ruth never once required her to account for the pagan, child-sacrificing, incestuous religious worldview she was raised in, as he simply redeemed her in front of witnesses and elders, making nothing of her life. Listen to me, folks. Making nothing of her life before but a distant and irrelevant memory as he brought her and bought her into a new life and new promises. It would be into his loving arms that she would remain and, listen to this, never look back to what the world tried to make of her. How does Jesus compare?
Yeah.
Jesus's gentle, loving interactions with the human race never once requires that we live in bondage over past baggage or sin. No matter how grievous our wages of sin and death, new life awaits all inhabitants of this property, earth. And Jesus submitted himself to the cross, paying the price for the redemption of the contract in blood, without a single person being required to first stand and account for who and what we were before we found him.
Yes.
In front of the heavenly elders, Jesus tore open that scroll and redeemed us all. We are truly the blood-bought, the church, the redeemed. New life, new promises, and it is into the loving arms of Jesus and the Father that we fall into, accepting this generous and gracious gift that we could have never earned while we, listen to this, never look back to what the world tried to make of you. Behold the Christ of Ruth.
Yeah.
Wow. Tiny little book. You see what we miss when we skim over?
Oh, my goodness. I'm telling you the truth. I'm sitting here blown away completely. Yeah. Donna, I think you've run away into a new dimension. Josh, what is she doing here?
I forgot we were even filming a show.
I know, no, seriously. Are we making TV or are we in church? I'm serious. That is just a sampler, a tithing of what is in this new three-book anthology. And we've not even skimmed the first book. And I want to take just a second to kind of highlight the reason that I'm holding three and the reason why it took three volumes to cover this. The first one is just the Old Testament. Volume two is the New Testament, and we're going to be dealing with this in the weeks ahead. And finally, volume three, the Apocalypse. And it's got this kind of systematic breakdown, Jesus from Genesis to Revelation. I also want to mention the fact very briefly that the promotional spot that you're about to see includes details. We are hosting the largest giveaway of the year with this three-book release, and we want to make sure that you know how you can get your copies of these books along with some free gifts that may really help as you go into the holidays. With inflation as bad as it is, people are really watching their ability and their capacity to make donations and to purchase Christmas gifts. So when you get this special offer, you'll also get some things that you can repurpose. If it's something you want to give to a neighbor or to a buddy or to a friend, or if you want to buy three copies and have three big boxes of stuff, take a look at this promotional spot. We'll be right back.
Ladies and gentlemen, Donna Howell, Dr. Thomas Horn, and Allie Anderson team up to bring you their magnum opus. Introducing the brand new three-volume anthology from Defender Publishing, The Mystery of Jesus from Genesis to Revelation. This new collection is being described by those closest to Dr. Thomas Horn as the most important body of legacy work he's ever written. And it's being offered right now in Skywatch TV's largest giveaway of the year. Skywatch TV is proud to announce The Mystery of Jesus Grand Giveaway. Volume 1 of The Mystery of Jesus from Genesis to Revelation begins in the Old Testament and reveals multiple ways that Jesus made personal appearances on earth called Christophanies prior to his birth through the Virgin Mary. The many links between Mount Sinai, the Day of Pentecost, and the Ascension from astounding but largely hidden revelations in the original Hebrew and Greek. How the words of the prophets regarding the someday Messiah preceded a 400-year season of silence and anticipation that led to disastrously incorrect interpretations of who he would be when he arrived, and so much more. Volume 2 begins in the New Testament and demonstrates what social and political events transpired during the intertestamental period that led to a movement of numerous false messiahs whose military pursuits splintered the Jews into various disjointed sects, each with their own misguided, documented messianic expectations. How extra-biblical and apocryphal books written around the time of Jesus give fresh insight on New Testament characters, their true identity and reputation, and how that affects proper biblical interpretation, the real and largely misunderstood purpose of Christ's ministry years on earth, and why there is an apparent deficit of miraculous manifestations in our day, and we're barely scratching the surface. Then Volume 3 moves directly to the apocalypse, where you'll learn clear-cut, comprehensible explanations behind even the most enigmatic and hard-to-understand symbols in Revelation that anyone can read and understand. How Jesus, present and active in all 66 books of the Bible, makes his grand and final entrance in shining glory to welcome into the New Jerusalem all who receive the free gift of salvation. And we're just getting started. Presented in three brand new volumes, The Mystery of Jesus from Genesis to Revelation is organized in a way that is guaranteed to fascinate and boggle the minds of everyone, from seasoned scholars to new believers. This is the life of Christ illuminated like you've never experienced before. When you order this incredible collection, you'll also receive the new Best of Defender Publishing ebook collection on data disc. Now, for the first time, this must-have assortment features 120 of the most information-packed best-selling books in Defender history, including the never-before digitally released version of the Defender Family Bible, featuring Old and New Testament with expanded Apocrypha. These full-length works are in popular ebook formats, so you can read them on Kindle, EPUB, PDF, and other handheld electronic devices. Give this collection as the ultimate gift to somebody you know this holiday season, or take them with you wherever you go. Valued at over $2,000 all by itself. But that's not all. With the holidays just around the corner, now's your chance to save big and receive bonus merchandise. As included in the Mystery of Jesus grand giveaway are any number of brand new super quality overstock gift books, DVDs, or audio sets to add to your library or give away as gifts this coming holiday season. Sold separately, these items hold a retail value of over $2,000. Yours now for your donation of only $35 plus shipping and handling. This is the largest giveaway of the year, just in time for the holiday gift-giving season, and is available only while supplies last. So don't delay. The Mystery of Jesus Grand Giveaway. Available now at SkyWatchTVStore.com. Order now or call 1-844-750-4985.
Welcome back to SkyWatch TV. I'm Joe Horn. We're going to continue right away. We're talking about the three new book anthology from Defender Publishing, Dr. Thomas Horn, Donna Howell, and Allie Anderson on the mystery of Jesus from Genesis to Revelation. And Donna, let's just continue immediately. Have any of you ever read through the book of Ecclesiastes and thought, this is kind of a defeatist book? I'm feeling a little worse off for having read it. That might be overstating it, but I mean, I've gotten that from pastors and youth pastors coming up, that that's generally the framework. The entire book discusses how everything in the world is meaningless or vanity. But Donna, this new series says, be prepared to immediately dismiss everything you thought you knew about Ecclesiastes, because there's a mystery behind the book that has yet to be unlocked. Mm-hmm. And you guys are claiming that this series is the only modern resource that has discovered this link. What is behind this very bold claim you're making?
Yeah, no, it's true. Okay, so here's the deal with Ecclesiastes. Solomon was following a literary device, a literary form that is now extinct across the globe. And it was only something that would have been followed by kings and pharaohs. We do know that this literary form existed. It's just that nobody's talking about that as it pertains to Ecclesiastes. But it traces back to at least 2000 BC. as the Mesopotamian texts show, for instance, The Good Fortune of the Dead, A Dispute Over Suicide, and the satire on the trades. I'm just listing three of them. But these were books that were written in the exact same style and flair as Ecclesiastes. Now, let me tell you what these leaders would do. This is not a common form that the commoner would participate in. Only a king or a pharaoh or some major ruler of the ancient world would write like this. But what they would do is they would start off using negativity, doubt, and cynicism as the framework within the way that problems could be solved. In other words, they would sit there and they would say, this is what's going wrong with you. This is what stinks in your life. I'm acknowledging your pain, O citizens, like a State of the Union address. Then they would blame the gods. This is the name of the god that was supposed to have your back. He failed. This is the name of the god that was supposed to have your back over here. He failed. I'm going to fix it. So the form that we no longer even have in the globe anymore was that they would sit down, say, this is what's wrong. I'm acknowledging your problems. This is why it's wrong. The gods have all failed you. And this is what I'm going to do about it. The way that the wealthy kings and rulers of the ancient world would address these issues that are happening to the people. So after they've explored the unanswered questions of life and they've done all of this negativity and doubt and cynicism, we discover that Solomon has a surprise ending that did not follow his contemporary peers. He says at the end, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Those two words, the whole matter, these are very important words. They're skimmed over all the time. But let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. What he's saying there is, I'm going to take everything I've just said and squash it down to one final point. He goes on to say, fear God, keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. Because God is going to know every work and every judgment, whether it be good or evil. This is a surprise ending. See, we read the book of Ecclesiastes and we're like, dude, what was this guy's problem? Everything's meaningless. Everything's chasing after the wind. In a very brief amount of time that we've got left on the clock, I'm going to use an example. Abraham was told to take Isaac up the mountain, sacrifice him, right? Mm. We as Christians read that and it makes us uncomfortable. Mm. Even though, yeah, he provided a ram, but it makes us uncomfortable. Why is God talking about human sacrifice? I'll tell you why. Abraham came from Ur. Child sacrifice was the norm. If God had just said, listen, if you're going to follow me, you got to use a ram instead. He might have gone, okay. But then a couple generations later, it didn't really mean that much. God used the mountain of human sacrifice so that he could say, now that you're up there, don't you dare lay a finger on that kid. I am the God that you are following now. I'm putting the holy smack down on this sacrifice. Yeah. I'm replacing it with the way I want to be followed and served, right? God used the illustration of the mountain. I like to look at Solomon as using the illustration of the mountain of pessimism to get to the end and say, listen, holy smackdown on your negativity. You hear me grumbling, Israelites? It's over. This is the whole conclusion of the matter. Stop grumbling about all these things. This is bad. That's bad. This is bad. I know. I'm your king. I know. I'm telling you. This is the bottom line. Serve God, obey his commandments. Yeah. That's the whole duty of man. What's the point? God's got the rest.
Yes.
It's actually a refutation of pessimism. It is establishing the opposite of what we think.
Wow. Unfortunately, we're all out of time, but fortunately, we've slated some additional weeks to cover the material in these three books. Ladies and gentlemen, Donna Howell.
Whoa.
Unbelievable. Next week, our guests return to explain how false would-be messiahs leading political revolts at the time of Christ was why the Jews didn't even recognize the arrival of their own Messiah. Does that sound fascinating?
Oh.
Wow. Please come back next week where we will continue this discussion. Ladies and gentlemen, for everybody in studio, everybody on panel, I'm Joe Horn. Keep your eyes on the prize, which is Jesus Christ. We'll be back.